Enough members present. In order to begin our proceedings, I do call this meeting to order. I would appreciate my co-chairs being here from the House, Representative Hurley and Representative Bowles. Looks like you don't have a seat. Joseph, let's scoot one.
Yeah, I got it right here. We got it.
I'll be standing the meeting, but you don't have to, Jamie.
It wouldn't see me now.
We have a lot on tap today. I would encourage anyone in the audience to please realize that you can always join us. These meetings are always broadcast over the internet. You can go to our JPS site at the North Carolina General Assembly's website, and you can tune in. You can also go back and listen to the proceedings. So all of you who are here taking notes and such, if you miss something, please just be aware of that. I think it's important. We chairs made sure that our meetings are broadcast and are available, and they should be instantaneously ready for you. And our sergeants at arms will also be recording it and downloading it. So we appreciate all that help. I would like to recognize my sergeants at arms from the House. We have, and if you would raise your hand when I call your name, we have Bill Bass, Bill right here to my right. We have Joe Cook. Joe's over here to my right also. From the Senate, we have Anderson Meadows right here to my left, and we have Steve McCaig in the back. So if you need anything during the meeting, please do call upon the sergeants at arms. We appreciate their help in making sure we have all of our materials and everything that we need to proceed in the meeting. Again, you are joining us for the Joint Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. Our agenda is here before the committee. Before we jump into the presentations, I would ask if I have a motion to approve the month before last's minutes. And I do.
So
that
moved.
Is from Representative McNeil, and it was seconded by Representative Stevens. All in favor, aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We will proceed to the presentations. We have follow-up questions from the January meeting. Those were some important. And again, for those of you joining us for the first time in a while, we did not have our February meeting because of the snow, the second snow for us down in Wilmington that locked everything up. And we went ahead and just moved February's meeting to today, pretty much, with the same items. So I'll go ahead and call upon the fiscal staff to please read us the question that we have and then update us on the answer from the January meeting. Who's going to do that from the fiscal staff? Okay, we have John Poteet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John, will you be handling all the questions?
Except the hard ones, yes, sir.
Okay, good.
You will have in your packet the follow-up questions from the January meeting. The first question we talked about somewhat extensively is, can prisoners use private insurance to cover their health care costs? In consulting with the attorneys and the members of our salaries and benefits team, they're not aware of any state or federal law prohibiting the use of private insurance for prisoners. However, it does appear that most employer plans and individual insurance companies do drop coverage when somebody is incarcerated. The next part is, the state health plan does continue to cover state employee retirees who are incarcerated, as well as their dependents who remain on an employee's plan. But however, it is noted that presumably state employees who are incarcerated would be terminated from their jobs. The second question was, would additional inmate medical costs be covered if the state had expanded Medicaid coverage? We're working with our Health and Human Services team, who are working with the Division of Medical Assistance over at HHS, to get more information about that, and we hope to have that for you at a future meeting. The question number three, about the status of the sheriff's arrangement with local hospitals to pay the same rate the state is paying. In consulting with the County Commissioners Association, they're working with their individual members. One of the major differences they have is they have 100 IT systems that have to communicate, whereas the state just has one system, but those efforts are ongoing. The question about inmate medical release that we had talked about, if you flip over, since the law was enacted in 2008, there have been 93 inmates who've been considered for the medical release program. 10 have been denied. 54 were released. 28 died, and one is still pending. And these are inmates who are permanently and totally disabled, terminally ill, or geriatric. They're incapacitated to the point that they do not pose a public safety risk. And then the exceptions are obviously inmates that are Class A felons, B1 or B2 felons, and persons are convicted of crimes that require them to be on the sex offender registry. They are not eligible for this program.
John, can you tell us who it is that makes the decision? Is it the head of DOC, or does the governor have to approve it?
Thank you, sir. It goes to the Post-Release and Parole Commission, and they're the ones who review the application and make that determination. The question number five, the NeoGov. The NeoGov is the state's new online applicant tracking system. Instead of filling out a pen and paper form to apply for a job in the state, there's now an electronic process. Has NeoGov changed the demographics of applicants? The state human resources is not currently tracking the characteristics of its job applicants. And then the final question, just give you some more information about state human resources and the NeoGov interface. Mr. Chair, that's all the follow-up questions we have.
Yes, Representative Mobley, you have a question for Mr. Poteet.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the last question, number five, with regard to applications being made online.
Yes, ma'am.
People having to go there and apply. Are the applicants notified or kept abreast of what the status is about a particular job?
So, Representative Mobley, in terms of how the interface works, there's sort of a series of modules. And so if you've applied for a job, then you're notified your application has been accepted. And there are a series of sort of triggering emails that keep people abreast, and then how the screening process works in some ways depends upon different agencies, but there is an interface between the applicant and the hiring authority.
Follow up.
If there is no information received by the applicant, can they go in and ask questions or do some kind of follow-up about the status of their application or the status of the position?
Representative, I'll need to sort of do some more follow-up. I've used the NeoGov system in doing some recruitment for the Fiscal Research Division, but that's a much, much smaller pool of applicants than Department of Public Safety would have or something like that. So I'll follow up with them about exactly how that process works.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Bryan.
I just wanted to add some concern in terms of experience working with folks who are using it. It's a wonderful system for the recruitment and application process, but the response to the applicants has been spotty, because I think that depends on someone in the agency updating, you know, giving some kind of input into the system. And some people, you can go in and see if a job has been filled or not, or you get a response, and some people never get a response. So it's been spotty, but anything you can ask about that or how it might can be improved, I think it will help the overall usefulness of the system.
Thank you, ma'am. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Poteet. One thing that I overlooked in my rush to get to the agenda was remarks from our chairs, and I will start with Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Senator Goodby. I'd just like to thank yesterday, thank the State Crime Lab and Christine Agler, I think she's here, for setting this up for the committee to go out to the State Crime Lab yesterday. It was very interesting, and have a whole different perspective. And I think there are some other things that we can do working with the DAs, the judges, and the crime lab and law enforcement that I think we can clarify some issues. But it was real interesting. I think we've got some great professional people over there. And so with that, I just thank the State Crime Lab for having us. And I think Judge John's doing a great job. Also, I have with me today is Nick Savain. Nick, you can stand up, Nick. Put that phone down. Nick is a junior at Union Pines High School. He's a member of the Cypress Point Junior Fire Department, which is a neighboring fire department where that I belong to. And he's also a member of my church youth group that my wife and I oversee. And he's in civics class, and so I brought him up here today. He's interested in public safety. And so this morning we were privileged to be at Representative Faircloth's emergency management hearing, oversight meeting. Today we're over here, and so he can learn something. And he's already told me he's going to replace me in a couple of years. So thank you, Nick. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Representative Bowles. We will now move to Representative Hurley. Representative Hurley, you have any remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to remind everyone, I think we've got one more tour of wherever we're going next time, but encourage you to go because it does help us do our jobs better. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Now we will move back to the presentations. Next up is the prison population trends with Susan Katznelson, the Executive Director of the Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission. Susan with us? Yes, ma'am. Come on up.
Good afternoon, chairs, and all the other legislators and the guests. Can you hear me? Thank you first for the opportunity to come here and tell you a little bit about the work we've been doing every year, and hopefully it is helpful to for your work in deciding about budgeting for the correctional system. I would also like to deliver personal greetings from Judge Spanauer, who is the chairman of the Sentencing Commission, and certainly all the other commissioners, some of whom are legislators who are here at this meeting. When the initial enabling legislation was passed for a sentencing commission in the state, it included in it already a mandate, an original mandate, to develop a model and try to project the need for prison beds and prison resources, and as part of that, obviously, for probation, too. So the commission has been doing that kind of work and that kind of projection. I think you've seen some of the results. We also give projections for bills that you introduce to try and see the specific impact of any one piece of legislation that might affect criminal laws. Just to give you a very short description of what is the general logic, what is the process, and I'm cutting it shorter than the presentation, Mr. Chairman, if it's loud, because that would take half an hour, and I don't think you want to listen to me for that long. The basic concept is we're looking at a prison population at a certain date, which is people who are in prison on June 30th, 2013, and that's the resident population. We also look at the people who were sentenced on or after July 1st, 2013, who will be the new population. And what you really have is the buildup of new people coming in for any number of prison sentences, and I can mention that in a minute, and then people who were scheduled to leave at a certain time. So the intercept between these two lines, if you will, on any given day is your population in the prison. It sounds easy, and then there is a whole model that's trying to actually figure it out. But the concept is very simple. People come in and people go out. So in any given day, whatever is the balance being in there, the new and the resident is your population. The new population is comprised of some major groups. One is people who get a prison sentence, an active sentence by the courts. The other important one is revocations, and I know you're all familiar with Justice Reinvestment, the act you passed in 2011, that changed the composition of who goes back to prison due to violations on probation. But that's another group that will go in one way or another to prison if they are violated or they get revoked. That's only for felonies. They also have some fair sentencing and pre-fair sentencing. People who are still on parole, if they are released on parole, they will come back if they get revoked. And then they have structured sentencing offenders who are released on post-release supervision, who can be, again, if they violate their conditions of post-release supervision, they can be pulled back to prison. That is basically the group that we get in the model. All of these groups are part of the incoming population. The department, DPS, and then the Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice also calculates a time for expected release for everybody who is not part of the resident population. So they step them down based on their projection of when they will be released. At the end of this whole formula and all this confusing setup, they also add people who are sentenced to prison, but they're misdemeanors. That's a very small number, and actually it's a shrinking number. So we don't project directly the misdemeanors who will be entering. DWI offenders who are not under structured sentences, so again, they're not in the model. And safekeepers, up to about 200 people who are sent up by local jails to be there. So that's what you really put in the whole composition of trying to see who is coming, who is leaving, and how many can we expect on any given day. It is an empirical model in the sense that it's always anchored in the latest year that already happened. So in this case, we looked at fiscal year 2013 for actual sentences imposed by the courts and looked at the releases up to that point by correction to see how much people on average served on the time that they were sentenced for. I don't know, sir, if you want to take questions in the middle or
whatever. I do. Is there a question from a member?
The next set, I just want to point to some of the actual findings, and they are usually look very simple. That's your table one, and that is the actual projection for the next 10 years. And I think that most of us would agree that the news are good because they projection shows that the population has slowed down tremendously in the past 3-4 years. The only increase that we see from year 2014 to 2023 is about 3%, which is one of the lowest that we've seen in a very long time. The other news that I know the department was glad to see is that their expanded capacity is still above the projected population for the 10 years. And I know that is the number that you look at more carefully, because in case you see great shortages projected, that's when you have to start to think about appropriating and possibly accommodating more beds. The standard operating capacity, we are above and have been above, at least in my 17 years here. So it starts to be almost fictional, but the expanded capacity has been usually lower, and now it is actually higher than the current population. So put it very simply, it doesn't seem that unless there are some unexpected changes in the state, that we will run out of regular prison beds. That doesn't mean that the department might not need more beds in terms of their overall correctional plans, but just as a straightforward assumption. This is also not a custody level projection, and I just want to, again, open the door for the department whenever they have that, because they have males, females, youth, and then they have high-level custody, more dangerous, less dangerous, minimum custody, and so on. So that still, the overall number of beds still might mean that they need certain types of beds more than others, and that's not part of it. They usually start from our projections to produce the custody-level projections and bring that your way, I guess, is the next step. One of the interesting things that usually is somewhat confusing about the 10-year projections is, why are we here every year? And I think that is part of the advantages of having an empirical model. Every year we project the next 10 years, but as things happen and they are reflected in the next year's actual cases, we come back and adjust it. So every year we'll come back and somewhat change the 9 years outward and then add the 10th year. So it's an annually updated 10-year projection. In case there would be some major change, let's say in the state, the population would decline. And the model doesn't take that into account, and we just gave you the 10-year projections and haven't redone it, we would be way over projecting of how many beds you need. So we're trying to stay on top of all the trends and come back with an annual adjustment for it. The model itself is a new model, and we were very grateful for being able to have a new model, and very grateful that SAS is literally in our backyard and managed to get a very, very high-powered model from the SAS Simulation Studio. The concept of the model is basically takes the criminal justice process and programs it in. So we feed in the data, which is the last year's cases and the way they were sentenced and their expected time to serve and so on. And the model takes them through every step and gives them the probabilities, the chances of some will go to prison, some will go on probation and so on. That really means that the model includes legal knowledge too and procedural knowledge. It's not just statistics. You have to know the law and the implementation of the law. Elements that are important in the model for predicting, for example, is the offense class and prior record level of offenders who will be sentenced. And I didn't bring a copy for everybody, but the grid, I know that you've seen our sentencing grid. That's where people get sentenced. That's how they get sentenced. So that is fed into the model to use that. The active rate, how many people in any given year get an actual prison sentence in that year? I believe this year it was 39%. The average length of sentence that is imposed and expected to be served. Again, on average, this year it was 34 months. Revocation rate, which used to be a very important player in any kind of prediction, and it is now changing because of credit for the confinement in response to violations that is part of the Justice Reinvestment Act. So that will factor into it. So really what we have a stream of people coming into the system, and then the model tries to predict what will happen to them at sentencing and as they exit. The Justice Reinvestment Act, and I'm not going to go over all of the major elements, but we try to summarize it in your handout. It really affects the major components of that prediction, and that is prison admissions, prison releases, and time to be served. All of these are changed. So in a way, if there was a year when it was important to update it annually, this was the year. Because all of the predictions that were based on pre-JRA changes, by definition, are incorrect. So it is also still changing. We've done some field surveys and visits this year, and the field is still trying to work it into their daily process of how to apply this new law, the Justice Reinvestment Act. So whatever we found now and whatever shows in the numbers now is probably not the final representative way it will be working in the field. So again, we are very glad that the model and the way we work with it allows us to update it every year to capture a changing reality. Another thing that I thought was interesting to maybe highlight for you is, I don't know if there are perfect storms, but in terms of crime and corrections, the past, maybe from 2009, was kind of a perfect storm. The population growth in the state slowed down. It's still growing, but it slowed down. And what that meant is that there are less people who can commit crime. So even if the crime rate were to stay the same, it depends on how many people are produced. Prisons don't go by rate, they go by actual people. So if the state is growing, there'll be more people, even under the same crime rate, who will go to prison. The other piece of good news was that the crime rate didn't stay the same. It has been declining nationwide, statewide. Nobody knows exactly why. Juvenile delinquency has been declining for years. There are some long-term trends that are figure four, the index crime rates, and it's all good news. The violent crimes, the nonviolent violent crimes, index crimes, they have all been declining. So obviously the pool of convictions, the pool of filings and convictions have been declining, and that helped again in reducing the pressure that we had on the correctional system. The third one was a number of changes that were made by you to the sentencing grid that lightened somewhat the burden of how many people will go to prison. And then by the department at the time that changed somewhat the way they grant earned time to offenders. So the time they served in prison as a portion of the imposed sentence has also gone down. So these two, again, were changes further down. And then the biggest change that hit after 2011 was the Justice Reinvestment Act. And I just want to mention two main contributions from that. One It basically took out misdemeanors from prisons, unless you have 180-day or longer active sentence imposed by the court, which is very rare. And if you look at the grid, that's just very much at the high end of the of seriousness. These people go to jail, to local jails. So a large group moved out not to come back. The other huge change was to look at revocation again, which has been most states and us too. At some point, there were more people going to prison for revocation than for an original prison sentence imposed by the court. What the Justice Reinvestment Act says, we'll continue working with offenders for violations until we reach a certain point beyond which they have to be revoked. So the first two times that the violations are serious enough, they get the confinement in response to violation, which is up to 3 months for misdemeanors and 3 months for felons. Only after two times, if they do it again and they're still on probation, can they actually be revoked, at which time probably the time left on their sentence isn't that long. So that created another huge cut that seems to be stabilized. I'll get to the actual chart to try and walk you through it, but these two hit pretty much immediately after the law was passed. They were all front end. The additional promise of justice reinvestment is rehabilitation, which will come more toward the tail end, and that should show up in a number of years as an additional cut in our need for prison beds. And that's assuming that the number of people actually convicted is not changing, but then the what we do with them might be changing. If you look for a minute at figure one, up to where we are right now, the beginning of 2014, it shows you the actual prison population. And you can see the peak in 2009, 2011, the two highest points in it. The declines after that were all the things that I mentioned, the lowering crime rate, the Justice Reinvestment Act, the changes that the General Assembly have made to the sentencing laws, and so on. The second part of that projection, when you have three lines, is the one where it's a projection instead of what had already happened, and the two forms of capacity, the expanded and the standard operating capacity. As you can see, the projection is between the two. It is creeping up toward the expanded capacity toward 2013. So in the later years, and of course, we will have updates every year. Right now, it seems that we will be basically filling all the existing beds and might need more. Figure two is simply taking the prison population part of the first figure and shows you the monthly fluctuation and the high point. The highest we had recorded from the department was October 09, almost 42,000 people in prison. What we have, I think it was January 1st, was 37,000. So it's a huge change in the right direction, I think, in terms of spending correctional resources. I mentioned already that for whatever we don't have empirical information on, we need to make assumptions. And some of the assumptions, well, the future is all assumptions because we really don't know what will happen. But one of the things we're watching closely and had to make assumptions is what will be the composition of prison admissions. Not only how many people will be sent to prison, but what they will be sent for. Is it an original sentence? Is it a revocation? And so on. Is it a violation of some kind? Another big hitter that we're really waiting to see and that hasn't fully implemented yet is post-release supervision. The Justice Reinvestment Act and you expanded it to all felons exiting prison. Until now, we only had it apply for the violent offenders, B1 to E, which is about 15% of the sentences. This is now everybody. They will be in post-release supervision, which is an added cost to probation, but they also are expected, at least some of them, violate the conditions of their post-release supervision and be revoked. That's an unknown. We know it's happening. We know it's the new law. We can't exactly estimate, so we put some assumptions about that. The confinement for a revocation The confinement in response to violations is another one that we know it is being used by the field, but we really don't know exactly yet how often they will reach it. There are also two other ways a person can be revoked: if they commit a new crime or if they abscond. Whether the courts will revoke more often now for absconding, and some of the definition of it has been changing too, it's unknown. So there are a lot of elements in which, instead of taking an assumption assuming things will continue the same way, in effect, we make an assumption that they will not, which clearly makes it much harder, even with a crystal ball, which we don't have. There are some other interesting changes that you made to the habitual felon law, and then adding a new habitual law for breaking and entering. The field has been pretty welcoming to these changes, and we do know that they're using it. Again, how the fallout will come from it in terms of more prison sentences or lengthier or shorter is not clear yet, but that's, again, we're waiting to see how that will play out. And just the last mention, parole, there are still people on parole. I know that the Postal Supervision and Parole Commission will tell you that they are not people that they are inclined to release at this point. They have been in for a long time. They are still 7% of the prison population, 2,463 last time we looked. 75% of them are lifers. So that is kind of a population that is sitting there, and we just carry it over now from year to year almost for the projection. And the final thing that we cannot account for is future legislation. Some sessions more than others, you do look at criminal penalties and change laws, and some will have minimal effect on prison needs, and some will be more measurable. So that's an open question, again, that we're ready to look at.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Dobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick question on the projections that are going down.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true for all custody levels admissions? For instance, is those that might be admitted to closed custody going down as fast or at the same level as those in minimum custody? Because I know closed custody is where the most expensive offenders are, the most expensive inmates. So is it going down for all custody levels, I guess, is my question.
I can partially answer it, and if the department, if you want to recognize, they might better. The only the initial offense of conviction would give us any hint as to their custody level. And violent crimes have decreased, so I wouldn't assume that there is a bigger portion of violent offenders who would have the maximum custody. But the department works with them, assesses them when they come in, and then they step them down. So I don't know at the final combination. I do remember years when they were mostly short on minimum beds, and so that I guess varies. And I think an equal challenge for them is the gender and age composition, not just the level. But all we can look at is what is the most serious crime they were convicted for. And that hasn't, I don't think the inner composition changed that much.
One quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I guess, and thank you for that. That does answer my question. I just want, just as we go forward, closed custody beds, again, are the most expensive, mm-hmm. and just projections as if we're going to need to build more of those closed custody beds, or if it's that way across the board. So look forward to working on those issues. Thank you.
The department's here. Would you like to respond to that question from Representative Dobson? Would you give us any additional insights? Thank you. If you all would identify yourselves when you speak.
Good afternoon. Tim Moose, Deputy Commissioner, Adult Correction, Juvenile Justice.
And Nicole Sullivan, Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Thank you. Please enlighten us.
Most of the offenders, when they come into the system, come in at either the medium custody or closed custody level, and then they have to work their way down in the system based on their behavior. There is not a decline in closed custody because, as we know, one of the principles of structured sentencing is that worse, more violent offenders stay in the system longer. So those beds are usually maintained close to capacity.
Thank you. Anything further? Appreciate it.
One more follow-up to them, if I could.
Follow-up question, Representative Dobson.
Do you anticipate more beds being needed at the closed custody level going forward?
That's a good question. At this point, we haven't done our custody projections to know the answer to that. Typically, the majority of the population, when we look at our projections, are going to be in minimal custody because, again, those longer-term inmates have worked their way down. So by proportions, the vast majority of the inmates are sitting either in medium or minimum custody, and the close custody group is a smaller proportion of our beds. But that's what our custody projections will tell us, what's the direction and needs of beds. And at this point, I don't have that report completed based on the most recent population projections.
Anything further? Thank you. Thank you so much. We appreciate your assistance. We will now move on to the exciting topic of the DPS motor fleet update. Dee Jones, Chief Operating Officer of the Department of Administration, please come forward and enlighten us.
Chairs, committee members, thank you for having me today. My name is Dee Jones, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Administration. I want to talk to you today about the collaborative effort between DPS and DOA over the last several months since we were here in November. In the last 60 days, we've placed an extremely large order of about 1,200 vehicles, 60% of which have gone to DPS. 702 vehicles for DPS and 507 for DOA's motor fleet and other agencies on the replacement side. This is the charter for the motor fleet operation, and as you can see on the footnote, there's still 630 vehicles that are over 125,000 miles, so we're in a hole, and we're not going to get out of it in a year, but we've made a pretty big dent over the last 60 days. Additionally, in the last couple of weeks, the budget office has indicated support for movement of lapsed salaries from DPS to DOA in order to fund 277 new vehicles. This would be for new employees, as well as for the change of community corrections officers, moving them from three people to one vehicle to one to one. It'll be a slow migration, but we are making progress. And as you can see, that's in the $5.3 million range. The motor fleet fund was at $37 million. Essentially, we've put in vehicle spend of $27 million. And we have the wash from the lapsed salaries from DPS. So we'll have a fund balance of $10 million at the end of this year. And that will be able to fund us. That's our benchmark for 4 months of operating. And we'll start this program and cycle all over again. The 277 vehicles, we are waiting on GovOps approval on March 27th before we can actually place that order. That's a budgetary issue. But we do anticipate approval to move forward with that purchase at that time. Are there any questions?
Questions from members? Yes, Senator Bryant.
I just remember there being some concern when DPS was here about us, you know, hiring workers who didn't have vehicles, like probation officers or something. And I just didn't know, does this activity by the motor fleet management group solve that problem, or do we still have a shortage of vehicles per employee who needs them? How does it fit?
That may be a better question for the budget office, but the 277 new vehicles is aimed at helping to put a vehicle into the hands of some of these new employees.
Follow up? Any other questions? Thank you so much. All right, Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you get us a little bit more specific about how these vehicles in DPS are going to be spread out? I heard the probation officers. Where else are they going?
The new vehicles?
Yes.
I may defer to DPS to respond to that question.
DPS, someone here to respond? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Please come forward, state your name, and enlighten us.
Good afternoon. I'm Lori Dollar, Commissioner for Administration with the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. With respect to the fleet order that has been placed, we are looking at putting approximately 281 of those vehicles in our community correction officer staff. 260 will go to prisons. 99 will go to juvenile justice, including court service counselor positions, as well as some with the YDCs and other areas. 19 will be with probation parole, 21 with emergency management, 5 with National Guard, 4 with correctional enterprise, 3 with Division of Adult Correction, and a miscellaneous number of 10 that were on the current assignment listing from the Department of Administration Motor Fleet Management printout as to vehicles the department currently had that exceeded the mileage guideline for the year.
Follow up,
Senator Newton.
Are none of them for Highway Patrol?
Highway Patrol has the authority by statute to acquire their own fleet, and they have a separate order. So this particular order and issue is not inclusive of Highway Patrol.
Thank you so much. Anything further from any members?
Mr. Chairman.
Hang on just 1 second. Representative Bowles and then Senator Bryant.
How many have they ordered this year? Or how?
Can someone answer that? Thank you. If you'd state your name for the record, please, sir.
Yes, sir. Billy Clayton on Highway Patrol. Representative, we've ordered 249 vehicles for this year. I'm sorry, 349. I got the numbers wrong. 349.
Thank you. It's just a decimal.
Thank you. Yeah, just one thing. I had 100 other things going on, but thank you.
Thank you, sir. And Senator Bryant?
I was just wondering if we could get that list she read.
Yes.
If it would be possible for the committee.
Christine has already asked for it, and we will see to it that it is emailed to all the committee members. Thank you. Anything further?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative McNeil, and then we'll Representative Burr.
My question is this. I see on your one chart that DPS got 702 vehicles, and then you're ordering 277 more, and that's, 979 vehicles. How big is their fleet? How much of it replace half of their fleet, a third of it? And it may be a question for DPS, but they're getting almost 1,000 vehicles. I'm just wondering how many they have.
If I'm not mistaken, the fleet we managed for DPS is around 2,800 vehicles. And so it's a substantial portion, maybe a third of the fleet. If I'm way off, maybe the DPS folks could respond to that. But I think that's pretty close.
Thank you. First, we'll go to Representative Burr and then Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the letter from Mr. Pope, and it looks like for these 277 vehicles that he has authorized, it'll be going to GovOps, that they're using lab salaries for that. Now, since they're putting in additional money, are they then going to have to turn around and lease these vehicles from you all? Are they going to have to pay some sort of leasing fee after they're buying them directly with their own appropriations, or how's that going to work?
Certainly. The motor fleet program and charter is actually to prepare for replacement going forward. So, yes, in fact, the upfront cost needs to be appropriated and or funded in some way. And then through the lease, you call it a leasing fee or a rental fee or whatever is the mechanism for which we charge for insurance, for the repair and maintenance, and then for ultimately for the replacement again.
Follow up. Is there one flat fee, or are there different levels of leasing arrangements that are made, and how's that going to work for those vehicles?
Yes, there's a fee. It's basically on the type of vehicle.
And
follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Where will they stand with those vehicles? Where are they going to be paying the max fee, or where will they?
Again, it's more tiered on the type of vehicle. So, for example, a Dodge Charger has a higher rental fee because their repair costs are higher. A Chevy Impala will have a lower fee because it's a slightly lower repair cost and depreciation cost, plus the initial cost of the vehicle is lower.
Another follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Okay, so they're paying this lease or this fee, and you're saying that it will be to help ultimately replace the car. This fee, has DOA, has Motor Fleet, put a policy in place to when DPS is paying this fee that money is going to replace the vehicles for DPS, for their vehicles, or is it still all the money from all the different agencies going into one big pot, and then it's basically being placed wherever you so choose versus make sure it's staying within that particular agency? Is it going into an individual account for DPS?
Currently, that answer would be no. It's going into a pool of funds, and it will be managed, again, as the greatest need arises, of which, with the largest portion of our fund, of our vehicle population being owned by DPS, then naturally they would get the largest amount of vehicle replacement money out of that fund, provided it doesn't no other circumstances remove money out of that fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the warranties on a typical sedan, not a highway patrol sedan, but a typical sedan used by a staff member, do we negotiate for a better warranty, or do we have to accept the straightforward factory warranty?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question, but I can find out.
Follow up.
I think that might be important to us. If we're working toward a point at which we can use a car until the warranty is complete and then get rid of it, which I think is the best way, then it would be good if we could negotiate for the best warranty we can get for the higher number of miles. So if we could get anything back on that, I would appreciate it.
Certainly.
Thank you, Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about mileage. Some of the departments use more than the others. Do you ever switch those out? Like if a probation person had a lot of mileage on theirs, somebody maybe from the prison who wouldn't use as much, do you ever do that?
Yes, thank you. We actually rely on the agency fleet coordinators to make those decisions, and they can within our processes.
Thank you. Follow up?
That's
okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members?
Mr.
Yes.
I do have one more.
Yes, Representative Burr.
Just looking, and maybe it's on here, maybe I'm missing it. With what you have, what you will be appropriating, what does that leave in Motor Fleet's account? How much, I believe, I'm trying to remember, what was the total dollar amount you said Motor Fleet was holding on to in December? You were over 30 million, I believe. What's left after you appropriate?
It's on slide 4. It's $10 million. It's about 4 months of operating expenses.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. Moving right along, the next issue we have is a report from AOC on compensation of court reporters. We have William Childs, Fiscal Research Division, that will present first, and then Mildred Spearman, Legislative Liaison from the Administrative Office of the Court, second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. William Childs from Fiscal Research. I just want to draw the committee's attention to a fact sheet that we have included in your packet. This contains some data about court reporters to provide some context for what we're about to hear. The first section mentions court reporter FTE in Beacon as of the end of January. At that point, there were 105 FTE. Out of those 105, 12 were vacant. Average salary is just over $54,000 with a range between $38,840 and $81,96. And the certified budget for court reporters at that time was $7.7 million, according to NCAS. Second section discussed transcript fees. Court reporters are allowed to charge a per page transcript fee on top of their salary, which goes to either AOC or AOC and IDS. This rate's currently $1.25 per page. Go up to $1.50 if the transcript needs to be expedited. In criminal cases involving indigent defendants, that is split with two-thirds going to IDS and one-third going to AOC. This model of compensation does appear to be the model in courts around the country, with court reporters getting paid for transcripts on top of their salary. In the 2013 appropriation bill, in the Senate version of the bill, the Senate eliminated half of the court reporter positions in the state, and then used half of the money from those savings to contract with third parties for court reporting services. Senate also put $1 million in non-recurring funds into the budget to provide for audio equipment to replace these court reporters. The House made no changes to this budget. So in the final bill, Session Law 2013-360, there are two special provisions addressing court reporters. In one, one directs AOC to report on the most effective and efficient deployment of court reporters and most appropriate payment, and that is what we will hear from AOC about in a minute. The other sets limits on the compensation of court reporters to cut their per page compensation in half in the current fiscal year.
And that completes. Thank you, William. Next, we'll hear from Mildred Spearman, Legislative Liaison, AOC. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Mildred Spearman with AOC, and the first presentation this afternoon from us will be about court reporters. The General Assembly enacted a special provision in 2013 that required us to study the use and compensation of court reporters, and more specifically, it required that we contract with the National Center for State Courts in order to do that. Before we begin, a little bit about court reporters in North Carolina. William has already provided some information. We have 105 FTEs as of August 2013. That includes one court reporting manager, 82 resident court reporters who are assigned to specific districts, 17 rovers who are unassigned and fill in the gaps generally, and we had five vacancies in August, but as of today, we have 11 vacancies. The compensation structure, as William said, is salary with an average compensation of $53,000, and then they do receive compensation for transcripts based on a per page rate. The rate paid by the state basically is $125 per page, and the rate paid by private parties is the negotiated rate between the private parties. Court reporters are responsible for paying for their own equipment. There are three ways to certify court reporters in North Carolina, two of which are still viable: the National Court Reporters Association, the National Verbatim Reporters Association, and the State of North Carolina, which no longer certifies court reporters. The levels of certification are the Registered Professional Reporter, which is the minimum level, the Registered Merit Reporter, and then the Certified Real-Time Reporter, which is capable of producing a transcript in real time. Typical experience for court reporters in North Carolina is an average of 22 years and an average of 11.3 years with the state. This is a slide about the general landscape, and of course there are always nuances, but the general landscape for preserving the record in North Carolina. We use court reporters primarily for superior court proceedings. other cases as ordered by the court. We use digital recordings for criminal proceedings in district court in which a defendant pleads guilty or no contest to an H or I felony, juvenile proceedings, civil trials in district court, certain proceedings before the clerk, vehicle seizure forfeiture hearings in district court, and there is no record required for misdemeanors, infractions, and trials before magistrates. The National Center study had this particular methodology. They documented current practice by interviewing key system actors. They did focus groups with key stakeholders, primarily Superior Court judges who had previously served as district court judges, attorneys, clerks, and court reporters. They also did a review of published reports and practices in other states. This is from the National Center report, and it shows the comparison of the other three states that I just previously mentioned. As you can see, North Carolina uses a combination of digital recording and court reporters. Virginia and South Carolina primarily rely just on court reporters, and Utah is an all-digital model which does not use court reporters. The National Center had five recommendations, and we will take each of these recommendations separately. Recommendation number one was that uniform best practices should be established and implemented by designated courtroom clerks who are charged with monitoring and supervising the creation of the digital record in district court. In relation to this recommendation, the National Center also recommended that we look at the equipment we are currently using and assess whether or not that is the type of equipment we need to be using. So what we intend to do is inventory all current recording equipment, determine the most promising practices and technology, assess the cost of purchasing digital recording equipment, and then after we have done those things, provide training to all courtroom clerks and other appropriate personnel on how to set up, operate, and monitor that equipment in district and superior courts. We also need to identify the best method for storing, archiving, and retrieving digital records. We need to set up clear policies and procedures for courtroom clerks or other personnel that may serve as monitors of this recording equipment, and we need to evaluate what the personnel resources would be to provide the type of monitoring of the digital recording equipment that is suggested by the National Center. Recommendation number two is that district courts should consider using court reporters for creating the record in termination of parental rights hearings. As I showed in the previous slide about the landscape, right now we do not use court reporters for the most part in district courts. So this would be a paradigm shift for us. So what we would want to do is convene a work group consisting of judges, advocates, attorneys, court reporters, and other stakeholders to evaluate the feasibility of using court reporters in district court and specifically in TPR hearings. We would need to examine the best practices in other states and to conduct an analysis of the cost associated with providing court reporters instead of digital recording technology in the TPR hearings.
Ms. Spearman, can you give us a reason for that second recommendation?
Well, it was a National Center report, and I think they spoke with focus groups, and there was a lot of frustration about the fact that sometimes the digital record might have gaps, and sometimes it's difficult to come together and agree on a record that you actually can use on appeal. So I think there are concerns about the digital recording, and I don't know if it's specifically the digital recording that we currently use, and if we had better digital recording, would this be an issue? But I think it primarily goes to the lack of faith in our current digital recording system.
Yeah, my thought was that you would need to address recommendation one before you moved on your working group on recommendation two. If it could be solved, as apparently Utah's done, with recommendation one and the proper kind of digital recording equipment, it would obviate the need for recommendation two. So thank you.
Recommendation three is that the court reporting manager should collect, assemble, and analyze monthly court reporter operational data in order to make empirically based resource allocation decisions. Right now, we do require court reporters to complete certain monthly paperwork. Unfortunately, we're very inconsistent in collecting that data. And the court reporting manager primarily relies on personal communication to track and to do this sort of analysis. So we agree that we do need to do a better job of collecting data that will allow us to determine scheduling decisions. Recommendation number four, the NCAOC should establish standard rates and a centralized system for private parties to pay court reporters for transcript production. We agree that we need to do this. However, we believe we need to do it as part of a comprehensive review of the current compensation structure for court reporters in North Carolina. Right now, we really don't know what court reporters are paid when they do transcripts for private parties because it's treated as pretty much a private negotiation. So we will take a look at that, but also we want to take a look at the compensation structure that includes the salary and the per page rate, because the shift last year in the per page rate has affected our ability to recruit and retain court reporters, and we really want to take a look at that if we could. Recommendation number five.
If you just hold on, Senator Bryant, do you have a question related to?
As we go along.
Yes, ma'am. Why don't we do that?
Not being a member of the standing committee on JPS, I'm lost about how this per pay rate process occurred. So if you could just explain the per page rate and how it works and how we and what is the consequence of the change and where are we now? So I think maybe we can all understand that.
Thank you, Senator Bryant. I think the chair will allow William Childs, if he has that information before him, to explain that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The current per page rate is $1.25 per page or $1.50 if the transcript needs to be expedited. In cases that don't involve indigent defendants, this will be paid by AOC, usually through the district attorney's office. In cases that do involve indigent defendants, the cost is split with two-thirds of the cost going to IDS and one-third coming from AOC. And on the fact sheet I included in the packet, I've got some information in the bottom paragraph about the amount that was spent last year on transcripts and the amount that is projected to be spent this year.
Okay. Follow-up. So this is paid directly to the court reporters?
Yes, ma'am. This is paid outside of, yes, ma'am.
And do we track that in any way, or is this just a part of their private business, or is this tracked as a part of their salary, or how is this managed?
It's not been tracked in the past.
We
correct? Yeah.
We do know how much we pay when the state asks for a transcript. When a private party asks for a transcript, we don't know what is paid between that private party and the court reporter.
That's the state court reporter.
If the state is paying, we do know.
Okay. Follow up. And so the
follow up and then Representative Bowles.
So the private pay would be on the civil side, is that correct?
No, it could be in any case.
It could be in any case. Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Representative Bowles.
Thank you. And I have the same concerns you have. I was invited to Robeson County. They were concerned about their court reporters. So at the end of the conversation, I said, I know what the state's paying. What are you getting paid per page? And the whole room kind of changed, and they're getting $5 a page.
Those are the state-employed court reporters when they do private work after taking the transcripts working for the state.
And just a follow-up, and so I asked, I said, is there a standard of what AOC or anybody, and they said no, it's individually rate what they charge.
Any follow-up? Okay, we'll continue. Thank you.
If I may add, I think that is why the National Center had this recommendation, because they decided we need to take a look at this, and we agree that we do need to take a look at the compensation structure. So we will be taking a look at that. Recommendation number five pretty much will track recommendation number one. Because the National Center recommended that we increase digital recording in Superior Court, but said there is a subset of cases in Superior Court for which we should have court reporters, and we need to figure out what those cases are. We also need to, as with district court, evaluate the cost of installing state-of-the-art digital recording equipment, and work with the district, the Conference of District Attorneys, to consider any changes to current calendaring practice necessary, because right now it's pretty easy. There's a court reporter in Superior Court. If we start picking and choosing the cases in which we have a court reporter, then our scheduling decisions, our calendaring is going to have to be a lot more precise. So contingent upon funding, we would install that digital recording equipment, and we would provide training to all courtroom clerks and other appropriate personnel on how to set up, operate, and monitor the equipment used in district and superior courts. I want to say right now the clerks in district court handle the monitoring functions for the digital recording equipment. It is not clear that clerks in superior court will have the time to monitor this equipment, so we would have to look at what other personnel might be needed to handle these monitoring responsibilities. So again, as in district court, we would have to evaluate the methods for storing and archiving these digital records, establish clear policies and procedures. And finally, the key points about the National Center study that we really want to hammer home are that the National Center report does not recommend the elimination of all court reporters. There's been a lot of media attention that says AOC recommends eliminating court reporters. That is not true. Both AOC and the report recommend an appropriate balance between the human element and technology. The National Center report details the court reporting model in three states to show the variance among the states, but it recommends crafting a solution very specific to North Carolina's needs. And the North Carolina stakeholders who participated in the study generally favored retaining the use of court reporters in Superior Court, and we have letters of support from the groups mentioned there. So in summary, the National Center report is a first step in this process. It identifies several decision points for NCAOC, and NCAOC will take the next steps of convening a stakeholder advisory group to identify which types of cases a court reporter should be charged with preserving the record, investigate the court reporting and staffing models in other states and the federal system, evaluate the most appropriate digital recording technology, and develop a strategy for the redeployment of our current court reporting personnel. Our final objective will be to develop a court reporting model for North Carolina that meets the state's specific needs, primarily to ensure the preservation of an accurate, reliable record in both district and superior court, and to find an appropriate balance between human resources and technology. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, follow up, Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Spearman, how does this compare with the two-year report that the National Court Reporting Association did? Did anybody look at that white paper they did where they'd studied it for 2 years with the input of all these other people?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with, the report. But I can follow up with you after the meeting. Okay.
Next, Representative Bowles.
Yes, thank you. On page 3, we talked about the compensation structure. The salary of average approximately 53, does that include the benefits?
I am not sure, but I will get that information to staff.
Can somebody speak to that on staff? Mr. Childs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 53 is it's either a median or a mean average, but that would not include benefits. That would be just straight compensation.
So that's 53,000 exclusive of benefits.
And the follow-up, and maybe to Mr. Childs, the average benefit is around 10 or 12,000.
That one I would have to look up. But I could get back to you in a few minutes. I can call that up.
And just for clarification also, that I understand, and I did talk to some court reporters, and I understand where they're coming from, and I do agree with the need for court reporters after hearing a couple of the Superior Court judges that were also in that meeting, because a lot of the digital recordings were not as clear to them when they played it back, as far especially in the parental trials. And I think the court reporters have a more accurate recording of what goes on. But I know that there was the concern of the private parties as far as the rate, and that there was no statewide structure or whatever. And I mean, that was, she admitted there was $5. Another county could have been six or four. And so I guess my question is, when they do these court reportings as a civil, most of these were civil, is it Monday through Friday, you know, 9 to 5 when they're on state time, or is this at night on Saturdays, private time?
I think that they are allowed.
Please answer.
I think that they are allowed to work on transcripts when they are not in court. So they can work on transcripts during the day.
You're talking, follow up? The actual depositions. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, the actual trial testimony.
No. I'm not talking about private deposition work. No.
Okay.
No, all they right. can't do that during the day.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, and excuse me, do we have an answer, William? And then Representative.
I don't have an answer for the current year. In 2012, the average for court reporter compensation was $47,772, and AOC at that point estimated that there would be recurring costs of $22,957 on top of that for salaries, benefits, and supporting costs related to offices, travel, that sort of thing.
So that's 22 on top of the 53?
Yes, sir. 23.
Okay. But I do understand that our court reporters are required to have their own equipment.
Yes.
They have to personally put forward their own equipment. And thank you, Representative Hurley, and then I believe Senator Newton, and then Senator Bryant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Then Representative McNeil.
Thank you.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on page 14, the recommendation number 5, I do know, having worked in the clerk of court's office, that training courtroom clerks and other appropriate personnel to set up, operate, and monitor the equipment when they don't have time and their work thing right now is horrible, and then you would have to pay a salary, evidently, to get another clerk. I think we really need to consider keeping the reporters.
Oh, well, our court reporters are hardworking folks, and the records, particularly in the criminal cases, are extremely important. Not having a record and having to redo a trial is a great expense to the state. We'll go ahead and recognize Senator Newton, and then Senator Bryant, and then Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't mean to rain on anybody's parade, but I appreciate the report. I think it provides us some useful information, but I think it also begs a lot of questions. And first off, I'd like to ask if staff and AOC could report more specifically on the all-digital system that they use in Utah and how they're able to make it work out there. I think that would be helpful to us as we move forward into the 21st century.
We'll direct our own staff. Would that be William? You would handle that, getting the committee information on the state of Utah's all-digital system?
Yes, sir. We can
okay.
do that.
Okay. Thank you, William. And if AOC could help us with the information they've gleaned from the NCSC, specifically with Utah. Thank you, Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to ask, Ms. Spearman, I'm sure you're familiar with the reports that y'all have issued and provided to us about the amount of time that Superior Court judges are averaging on the bench these days. And am I correct that that would be fair to say that's 10 hours or less a week on average?
I don't know that that would be fair to say, Senator.
Can you speak to that?
I think the last report we had was it was actually less than 10 hours. I was trying to be generous. Maybe Mr. Childs or somebody could help us out.
Yes, sir. We found less than 10 hours, but staff does caution that some of that data may not be the data needs to be massaged further.
Mr. Chairman,
I believe the additional time, Senator Newton, if I remember correctly, was time that the judge would spend back in chambers. But I believe the reported time was around eight and a half hours, depending on if it was a special superior court judge or an elected superior court judge. And I believe the off numbers dealt with potential time the judges met with parties outside the presence of the public in chambers, in camera, and also reading motions and doing all that kind of work and writing orders.
May I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Okay. Thank you. The reason I asked that question is because, as a trial attorney, who has ordered many of these transcripts myself for appeals, I'm very familiar with court reporters and all the ones I've worked with, I think are wonderful and do a good job. And I'm not trying to take anything away from the job that they're doing. They are human. I've had instances where the court reporter couldn't produce the transcript because their equipment or themselves, it was lost or unable to be provided to me, despite the fact that I would have paid five or whatever the fee was that they charged me. But I'm unaware of any instance where you would have need of a court reporter when a Superior Court judge wasn't on the bench. And so my point that I'm trying to point out to this committee, as well as to the AOC, and why we need to continue to investigate this and decide how the best for the state to handle it is, by my understanding, we're paying on average $53,000 a year in salary, plus 20-some-odd thousand-dollar in benefits and costs, for what apparently would be an average of less than 10 hours a week in court time. And on top of that, they're working hard. They're transcribing transcripts for me as a private party and other lawyers. They're transcribing it for AOC, paid AIDS, either public defenders, appellate office, or others. And they're being paid a fee on top of that to transcribe those transcripts, whatever needs to be done. And so I think it's important for us to realize that if someone has no more than 8 to 10 hours an average a week in court transcribing what's being said in court, and the rest of the time they're getting paid extra to produce the transcript copies for the various parties that have requested them, you know, that's something that we need to look at when we're looking at a budget that is stressed and strained all over, and what we can do going into the future to make sure that we're producing the transcripts accurately where it's needed, whether it's termination of parental rights, whether it's a criminal defense trial. And we're also trying our best to save the state money as we go forward. We can see what this costs in terms of salaries, and we can, and benefits, and we can see what this costs in terms of paying for actual transcripts. So, you know, I've never been able to negotiate as a private party with a court reporter who produced the transcript. I mean, they write the transcript, and I've got to pay whatever the fee is that they tell me it costs per page. You know, I'm not usually one for putting caps on private negotiations, but I didn't really realize that I had freedom to negotiate. Maybe I'll try that next time, see how it works for me. I doubt it'll work too well, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newton. And I believe next was Senator Bryan and then Representative McNeil. Yes, do you have a response? Yes, you may follow up.
Thank you, Senator Newton. We are very much aware of issues that we need to address. And part of recommendation number 4, we said that we will do a comprehensive review of the current compensation structure. The thing about North Carolina is there are some small counties where, yes, the judge may not be in court every single day, but there are also some counties like Wake, Mecklenburg, Guilford, where the court reporter and the judge are in court every single day of the week. So the difficulty for us is looking at the model that is North Carolina and realizing that we have Terrell County and we have Mecklenburg County. So we are very much aware of these issues. We intend to address them, and we hope that we have the support of the General Assembly in doing so.
Thank you, Senator Bryant.
I just wanted to make a comment in support of the statement Representative Hurley made, and that is the concern about getting rid of court reporters and then making the clerks do extra work. And everything I hear from my clerks is how many FTE they're losing and how hard they're barely holding on to make things go with what they have, and I just worry about that and think, and my concern is how can that even contribute to the reliability of the preserving the record process when there are also other records that we rely on the clerk to do that have to do with people's constitutional rights and perhaps even their freedom, you know, their immediate, you know, the issue of their immediate freedom, etc. So I just want to urge a caution and express a concern about that. And then the second thing was about transportation. Do the clerks provide their own transportation? Are they using state motor vehicle fleet?
No.
Equipment? Well, does it depend?
I'm not sure about the Rovers. Do they have state vehicles?
Can someone answer that? Mr. Stahl, would you like to answer that for the record? Who?
No, Mr. Shaking Stahl your head.
Yeah, push the button and state your name.
I'm David Duster. I'm the court reporting manager. I have two Rovers who do have state cars, but the great majority drive their own cars.
Thank you, sir. Okay, we will. That it, Senator Bryant. Thank you, Representative McNeil. Then Representative Stevens.
And this may be a question you can't answer, but maybe staff can get it for me. We've talked a lot about the fact that court reporters supply their own equipment. I, for one, would like to know what kind of equipment they supply, how much that costs, how often they have to replace it, what's the maintenance cost on it. I mean, I'd like to know how much skin they got in the game, I guess you'd say. And then also, I'd like to know, you're talking about switching over some of the courts to digital recording, and maybe some of our digital recording equipment is not up to par or current standards. I'd like to know what it would cost to move some of those courtrooms to digital recording.
And I believe there money, did the money stay in the budget that was originally allocated for the digital recordings?
No, sir, it did not.
It did not. Okay. That is something that in our continued push for courtroom technology, there was initially money in the budget for that. In addition to talking about our clerks, who is a group that I deal with on a daily basis, next to that would be the court reporters and, of course, our bailiffs. But we tried to put money in the budget this last year because, you know, in court, I will tell you all, I was in court this morning. I'm in court pretty much every day that I'm not here except for Saturday and Sunday. And we still do everything that we did in the 1950s in court when it comes to paperwork, except we have an overlay now of adding it all into the computers too. So everything we still write down, we still transfer it over, and then we put into the computer. And it looks like most of the time a computer from the 1970s, a big green screen with that kind of technology running the whole thing. And I pushed hard this last time, but again, with the tight budgets, we were not able to put the money back. Senator Newton also in this committee, so many of you members, we wanted to have a trial program in a smaller county to actually use technology and to see what we could do about taking our court system into the new millennium. And it needs to be taken into that. I mean, we've got to do something. What we do now in court is just crazy, and it is so repetitive, and it's so time consuming, and our clerks literally do everything they did in the 50s, and now they put it all on an antiquated computer system, and it's just ridiculous and foolish. And until we expend a little bit of money to figure out how to do what in many cases the federal government's done it right now, you can look at the PACER system, public access to court electronic records, everything you file from your office. You literally put it in a PDF file and you file it with the federal clerk. It goes out to everybody. There's no mailing. There's no muss. There's no fuss. And we need to start thinking about all those kind of things. And I would urge you, I will not be with you. It's my last session in the short session. But I really urge you all to please, as we move forward in this state, I beg you as a practicing attorney, we've got to do something. It's just crazy. We have technology that would save so much time and energy, whether it's digital recording to help our clerks out with their workloads, and it's technology for electronic, putting all of our court records electronically so they're available. I'm excited about what we're going to have next as we finally gotten around to credit card projects, but I know we're talking about our court reporters now, so I will cease and desist at this point. Did you have anything else, Representative McNeil?
That's fine. If they could just get that information for me. I know you don't have it off the top of your head.
Well, the best person to address that would be the gentleman that just stood up. Could you identify yourself again, sir?
I'm David Jester. I'm the court reporting manager.
Yeah, David, if you could, Mr. Jester, if you could for us, and we'll make sure our staff follows up with you. Representative McNeil wanted to know the amount of investment, which I understand several thousand dollars for my local court reporters into the equipment they have to purchase, what their costs are with that equipment and the upkeep on a yearly basis, and what else, Representative McNeil?
How often it has to be replaced.
Okay.
I'm sure it has to be replaced every 2 or 3 years.
That technology is always changing. And if you could provide us with that to our staff, and we'll make sure to have it brought forward in the next meeting.
Sure. Court reporting systems are like any other technology. There's a range of prices you can choose from. And since they provide their own, they get to pick. But starting price is usually about $10,000, and it goes up from there. Most of us pay annual maintenance fees, which saves on some upgrade costs. That's about $1,000 a year. And with the annual maintenance fees, I've been able to only have to upgrade about every 5 years. I can't speak for every court reporter, but I think that's a pretty solid average.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Stevens?
Thank you. Thank you. And I think mine are more in comments, trying to perhaps bring together some of what we're all talking about. The court system is full of people and people with problems who need to be heard, and some of them clearly more serious than others. I'm all in favor of us getting our paperwork, getting it digital, getting it in there. And with court reporters, when they're required to attend Superior Court, are required to be there until the judge releases them, even if the judge is in the back talking with people or whatever he's doing. So I do understand the court reporters have to be there. Sometimes they can be working on other things, and sometimes they cannot. Before we move to a completely digital system, though, we need to truly look at what's been happening with the ones we do digitally record compared to other states as well. At this point in a civil district case where you have the digital recordings, you have a remedy. If it cannot be transcribed, you get a whole new trial. You start from scratch if you've got an appeal and you can't get a record because the digital recording is not well. In juvenile cases, you're going to have people testifying, perhaps at times even little children, where you may not be able to pick up their voices. And that's something that's pretty important, takes a long time, and we don't want to retry it. Then the same thing in Superior Court. If you spend a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks trying a major murder case or a major criminal matter, you don't want to use digital recording and have to go back and retry that entire thing again and put a whole new jury in place. So that's something we need to proceed closely on. But the one thing that came out to me in here, and I'm looking at it also in the foster care situation, it appeals from termination of parental rights and things like that. Do we have a procedure for indigent defense to say this is not appeal worthy? And that may save some transcript costs. Do we have that ability to say we don't find any reason to make this appeal? And I think that's important to perhaps cut back on some of these transcripts.
Thank you, ma'am. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a transactional attorney, and the courtroom experience I have is with juvenile cases, like Representative Stevens just mentioned. So that's the digital system. So I'm not particularly familiar with the court reporting situation. But from what I'm hearing today, it sounds like we have a kind of an odd hybrid situation between a full-time employee and a contract employee. If they're providing their own equipment, and if they're providing in many cases their own transportation, and they're at the same time getting paid a per piece rate as well as a salary, where did that model of a salary and a piece rate at the same time come from? Can anybody answer that?
Can you answer that, madam?
I think that's in line with the nationwide model. That's not uncommon in other states.
Mr. Wow. Jester, can you confirm that for us? Is that what you've seen in other states?
Yeah, 100 years of court reporting has determined that that's the best way to only pay for what you get. And so not just nationwide, worldwide, that's the way it's done.
Thank you, sir.
Follow up.
Representative Jordan.
I think Mr. Jester was getting more towards my question, which was I'm trying to understand why that system is in place. And I heard that I thought it might be because you have to do transcript work outside of the full-time position, but it sounds like you can do transcript work while you're on salary. So I still don't quite understand why that's the case. Why are they on salary? Why don't we move to just all contract if that's the way it's going to work? I mean, what is the salary there for? Is that for the time in the court? And then when they prepare the transcript, that's why there's an extra piece rate, because that's additional work? Does that... Ms. Spearman, is that...
Representative Jordan, all I can say is that is the traditional model, and that we are committed to looking at that and determining what is the best rate of compensation for North Carolina court reporters. So mm-hmm. All I can say is that is the traditional model.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Additional question. My next question is, we've heard some concerns about private fees, and I was sitting here wondering why we were concerned at all about that, because if private attorneys and want to or want to coordinate that and negotiate that, that's fine. Is there a concern because the work that's being done is in the court system, so it's almost like a work product issue of the court reporter, and so they have a monopoly on that information, or why isn't that contract rate discussed before the trial and before the transcription begins so that different court reporters can be brought in to give bids or whatever on the per page rate?
I may be speaking out of turn, but I believe the concern is that when you need a transcript, you need a transcript. And if the court reporter has the transcript, your negotiating power is not as great as it would be if you could get a transcript from any of 50 different people. So.
Representative Jordan, thank you. Any more questions? And I do think part of the issue with our court reporters and having full-time folks, I believe, was originally started, Representative Jordan, as I understand it, from having talked to my local court reporters, is, you know, we do have a lot of downtime in court. And to have people there that are contracted that expect, like court reporters who come to our offices when we're doing depositions, they know they're going to be there for a deposition. They're going to get paid for their deposition time, and they're going to get paid for a transcript, as opposed to having independent private contractors hanging around the courthouse hoping that the judge gets finished with the attorneys and back and the trial starts or it's settled. So I think that's the $64,000 question that is the tug on everybody, because the Constitution mandates, you know, we have records in our criminal cases and we want them the same in the civil cases. So, you know, that what I think that's part of the issues that we deal with. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Something you said implies that the ownership of that recording belongs to the person who took the recording. Who actually owns that work product?
I believe we actually own the work product.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yes. Yes, you may, ma'am.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify one thing. Representative Bowles, I know you seem to have a lot of concern about the court reporter median salary that we mentioned, the $53,000. Again, I did want to point out that our folks have 22 years of experience as court reporters, so they're not green. They're experienced court reporters, and they're paid accordingly.
And to follow up, I understand that's the mean. Mm-hmm. There's lower and there's higher.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the most part, too, I mean, court reporters in the legal world are well-paid individuals, highly skilled, well-paid, and that's the kind of people we want in our court system. So I do understand that, most definitely. Thank you. Nothing further. We appreciate your assistance very much.
Ms. Spearman, I just wanted to share with you that study I was talking about.
Yes.
The cite to the white paper on court reporting.
Thank you, Representative Stevens. Okay, we're going to move on to the next item, and we have at the standstill, Ms. Spearman. This is AOC report on credit card payments. This is something that Senator Newton and I and several of the other members of the committee worked hard on for quite a while to see that happens. My local clerk is very excited about it, and I'm excited to hear your presentation and how all this is going. Please begin.
Okay. This next presentation is about credit card payments in the clerk's office. Before we begin, I want to point out that we already had PayNC Ticket, which allowed you to use a credit card, but not in the court's office. You could be at home and pay your ticket with PayNC Ticket, but not actually in the clerk's office. So the special provision required us to implement a pilot by January 1 of this year, and we have accomplished that. In the beginning, we chose 6 pilot counties, Allegheny, Forsyth, Halifax, Mecklenburg, New Hanover, and Union. We felt that these counties were representative of urban, rural, large, and small counties. Collectively, these counties make up approximately 18% of the state workload. We established a credit card advisory group consisting of 1 clerk from each of the 6 pilot counties and representatives from NCAOC's technology, financial, purchasing, legal, and communications staff. The group objectives were to make recommendations regarding credit card payments, review the system, training plans, rollout plans, and approve commencement of the project, and to assess lessons learned from the pilot and make recommendations concerning statewide implementation. Laying the groundwork consisted of, we had to develop a web-based application that interfaces with our current financial systems and the credit card vendor. We had to enhance financial systems to allow acceptance of credit cards. We contracted with a security consulting firm to evaluate NCAOC's security framework. We upgraded data security measures in the pilot counties. We purchased and installed equipment, including the credit card reader, devices, and printers. And we established procedures and processes for handling chargebacks, voids, rejected, and misapplied payments. The scope of the credit debit card acceptance, we have four vendors, American Express, Discover, MasterCard, and Visa. There's a limit, a maximum payment of $1,000. The customer pays a portal administration fee for each transaction, which amounts to 2.25% of the total amount due paid for credit card processing, and $1 for the third-party vendor services.
Can I stop you right there? I have a question regarding that. I, in my small law firm, I think I've gotten my bank rate down to about 1.2, 1.3%. And I'm just trying to figure out, does all that money, please tell me all that money does not go to the credit card processor, plus what's the dollar fee for? I mean, that's for the millions of dollars from the state that'll go through this system. Why in the world are we paying that high a fee plus an extra dollar just to use a credit card?
Okay. The 2.25 is what the credit card company charges for the transaction. The $1 is what we pay to our third party vendor who actually handles the credit card information, which we do not. The customer pays this. This does not count, come out of the total fees due the state.
So this is what we negotiated, a rate of 2.25% plus an extra dollar for the vendor, all to be paid by the person who wants to use a credit card so we can get a payment into the state. Okay. I just wanted to verify that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And if I may, we had a very short time to implement this pilot, and had we had more time, we may have been able to put this out to bid.
I do have a question. Did we go through state contracting and use the rate that the state gets, or did you all contract independently with this credit card processing agency?
Well, this is the same company that we use for PNC Ticket. So
that's not my question. Did we go through the state, or did you guys do this on your own? State contract and purchasing?
I have some technology folks. I don't know if they know the answer to that.
Can somebody stand up and answer that question from AOC? Nobody?
I'll get that to staff, sir.
Thank you. Judge Smith, good to have you with us as always. We can't hear you.
Based on the timeline, we used the credit card system that was in place rather than put it out to bid. It was not put out to bid under the state contract because we felt that time was of the essence. Had we put it out for bid, it was our opinion and judgment we could not comply with the statutory timelines. We will have this fully implemented within your timelines. There's nothing that requires us to stay with this company. So down the road, once it's in place, we'll take a look to see whether a better deal can be obtained. But I felt like, based on what I heard, that we needed to meet the timeline.
We do appreciate you meeting our timeline.
This was the only way to do that, and the customers appear to be glad to pay it.
They do, and thank you, Judge. We appreciate AOC's efforts to meet the General Assembly's requirements very much. Please continue.
Okay, we have some exclusions based on increased financial risk. Those exclusions are for alimony, bond forfeiture, cash bonds, child support purge payments, civil judgments, condemnation awards, disputed funds, rent funds, trust, and upset bids on foreclosures. None of these can be accepted using a credit card.
Representative Jordan.
Why can't child support purge payments be taken like that? They're usually less than $1,000.
Our thinking was that we didn't want to accept payments for anything that we have to remit to a third party, because in case there is a chargeback, we don't want to have to go to one person and then to another person and try to get money back from that person who is pretty innocent in the process. We had a phased implementation approach. We implemented a soft rollout in December of 2013. You have the dates there for the counties and the rollouts. We offered on-site training and support personnel at each rollout, and the advisory group identified and resolved potential issues. By the numbers, as of February 28, 2014, we'd processed almost 4,000 card transactions and over $700,000. As of yesterday, we cracked $1 million and more than 4,000 card transactions. The cost for the pilot were approximately $313,000. Estimated expansion to the remaining 94 counties is $835,000. Those costs include implementation, equipment, training, and compliance with applicable credit card security requirements. The portal administration fees paid through February 28th, based on the numbers above, are about $16,000 for the credit card companies and $4,000 for the third-party vendor.
Can you help me out, please, with the pilot implementation costs? Because I'm thinking that we're paying the third-party vendor. Is that who? Do they provide a portal, a machine? Is that what you're talking about?
May I defer to our technology staff,
sure.
Anthony Whitmore?
Please identify yourself, sir.
Anthony Whitmore with AOC.
Yes, sir.
So what was the question again?
The question was, where does the $313,000 come from, the pilot implementation costs?
I think that's, help me out, Matthew. I think that comes from some infrastructure purchase, credit card swipes themselves, these types of devices, as well as the most of it is personnel costs, training, travel out to the counties, personnel costs to actually implement into the 100 counties.
But now this is initially just for the pilot, which was 6 counties, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
$313,000, you think it's primarily in personnel costs?
There was also, we did consult with a private company regarding security, and I'm not sure the exact cost of that consulting fee, but that was part of the pilot cost.
We can get you a breakdown.
That would be great. Can we get that for the next meeting? Can staff make sure we have that? Thank you.
Sure.
And then you're expecting another $835,000 to implement it in the remaining counties. And then the equipment, I'm trying to figure out what the third-party vendor cost is with the dollar per transaction. Is that simply their rental of the machines to us, or?
No, if I could explain it.
Sure.
What we do, imagine we have one of the swipe devices, on a computer. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we would print out the actual court receipt. And then we would ask the person, do you want to pay with a credit card? And if they say yes, then what we do is we go to the third-party vendor site. And then the credit card information is given to that third-party site. We don't capture the credit card information. So the $1 for the credit card vendor is for handling that process, handling the financial data. Because part of the security that we had to pay for is that if we have the third-party vendor, we don't have to be, we don't have to comply with as many of the PCI standards as we ordinarily would if we were actually capturing that data.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so expansion to the remaining counties began on March 1st. We have 23 counties live as of March 7th, and those are the additional counties aside from the pilot. We're rolling out the pilot to a limited number of counties each week. We have ongoing training and personnel support at each rollout, and we hope to complete implementation by June 30th, 2014. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
Does the full implementation include, because one of my hopes that we discussed in committee when we were talking about credit cards was the ability, I would love to see people that I represent be told by the clerk when they walk over to the clerk's desk after going before the judge, here's your case file number, go home, go to AOC credit card, whatever it is, .com, and you can take your case file number, put that in, call up what you owe and pay it with a credit card online. Do we have online payments? Because part of my hope was when I was down in my clerk's office and originally sort of came up with this idea, I saw a kid who I could tell was a blue-collar worker who was standing in line on a Thursday afternoon waiting to pay his probation fees. And he was on probation for 24 months, and he was in his 22nd month, and he had to get off work at about 3 o'clock every Thursday, one Thursday a month, go to the bank and get cash, drive to the courthouse, park his car, walk into the courthouse, go down to the clerk's office, stand in line, and pay. And then, I mean, and I was just thinking about how much incredible work that was, and loss of pay and loss of productivity in our state for all these probationers to do that. Then, after he left, I was next in line to pay one of my client's fees, and I asked the clerks, how much of y'all's time is spent with kids like this coming in to pay probation fees? Two clerks in New Hanover County, they said about 40% of our time is spent doing just this. And I thought, well, our clerks are overworked. They could sure use some help. If we could take credit cards, that would free up 40% of their time, of these two clerks, just in that section. And that's one reason I think that being able for that kid to be able to go online, put his credit card information and pay his probation fees and his court costs and everything else that are rolled in there. The same with folks that I represent in traffic court. What I have to do right now, I'll be in traffic court tomorrow. I'll handle a lot of tickets for people. I'll call them up. I'll either have to pay, get them to pay $20 so they can have 30 days to pay their court costs and their fine, or that's the installation fee that we currently have under the state system, or they'll have to come to court that day before 5 o'clock and pay their fees. And, or I have to go as an attorney and get a separate check from them, put it in my trust account, let it clear, and then pay it with a law firm check. And Leo, you know how much of a hassle that is for just the average person. So I'm hopeful that as we go along, and please tell me, is there a plan or online payment that will be coming out in the near future?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, right now we do have Pay NC Ticket, which allows you to pay waivable offenses.
Right, which is the worst thing anybody can do. And for anyone listening, never, ever do that. If you do that, you'll be guaranteed the maximum number of points that you can get on your insurance for 3 years. So don't ever do that. But when it comes to action, unless you've talked to an attorney and you know, call Leo.
Yeah.
But I hope that we're going to expand this system so that folks who do go into court are going to be able to pay online, not just those who go in and plead guilty to a traffic offense. Please tell me we have a plan.
I think we have a plan.
Do I see head shaking back there? Judge Smith, do we have a plan?
We, of course, have a plan. I would just say that this is a complex issue. It is not simple. We have avoided a major expense by not having to comply with all of the credit card industry security requirements by making this the third-party vendor. It's not going through us technically. If we did an online service, it's very difficult to set it up that way. We do that now with Pay NC Ticket. It's set up for Pay NC Ticket to do a direct online. It is our plan to try to do that down the road, but it's not part of this pilot. We didn't want programs creep to delay it. So we've kept it fairly simple and straightforward. Once we get this up and running and it's in place, reliable, and we can assess the risks. Right now, the person who hands the card to the clerk is the person whose name is on the card. When you move to a different format, you introduce risks that have to be assessed. We have no appropriation to cover fraudulent charges or chargebacks. So that will come straight out of somewhere that's not appropriated. Those are all the kinds of issues that have to be discussed. But yes, we have a plan. It's my goal to make it online.
And I'm wondering also, do we know how much greater our collections are in these pilot counties now based upon the cross-price elasticity of using a credit card versus somebody having to have the cash in hand?
There is no evidence that collection rates are improving. There is definite record to show that it is a preferable method of payment. We've already collected over $1 million.
But that's not more than we were showing in the prior months around the same time period. It's not a higher pay rate.
I haven't looked at the figures, but my impression is the same people who would have paid before are now paying. It's just with the credit card.
Because I have found in my own law practice, and I think other folks who have businesses with credit cards, my clients are more than happy to pay immediately instead of waiting, because I have taken credit cards. I would ask staff if we could follow up on that as we get more data in and see if indeed the figures start showing a greater income of money to AOC, which I hope would be significant enough, Judge Smith, to be able to obviate your fears of fraudulent chargebacks, and so that you'd be getting more money in. And if you did have some fraud where there were chargebacks, AOC is much, much better off taking the credit cards, even with the fear of an occasional chargeback, so that it doesn't negatively impact your budget, because I understand your concerns there.
I agree with everything you've said. I just want to make it clear that everything we collect goes to the general fund, not to the AOC.
I understand. And we sure don't want to have those chargebacks. And I don't know how they would affect, if that would simply go to the general fund or affect your budget. So we'll be cognizant of those concerns as we move forward. Thank you. We'll go ahead and recognize Senator Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Newton may have a follow-up if I don't touch all the points on this. But I wanted to go back to slide 9 for a moment.
Page 9?
Under the section about cost implementation. And I guess specifically with regard to the expansion of to the remaining 94 counties, and that seems like a significant cost, $835,000. I guess I'm wondering, if I'm a credit card company competing for this business, you know, why wouldn't I sort of be anxious to provide equipment to counties, to provide training to counties, so that the state wouldn't have to spend $1 million to expand it? I guess that's question one, is, you know, why are we not trying to get some competition involved in having the vendor cover that cost? And secondly, I guess I heard the judge, I think correctly, say a minute ago that we're not increasing any collection rates with this. So can we justify expanding it to 94 counties if we're not going to improve our collection rates? Is there some other benefit that we're not considering? Is the credit card system going to save us enough clerk time to justify expanding it? So I guess I just wanted some input on that.
I think,
Mr. Chair? Yes, please.
The answer to the first part of the question is that, again, we had a very limited time in which to implement this pilot, so we went with the vendor that we were already using for pay and see ticket. So obviously down the road, as Judge Smith said, we will be able to look at, can we get a better deal for the citizens of North Carolina? We may not be able to, but certainly we would like to look at that. The second part of the question is, we just don't have enough information right now to ascertain whether or not there are any savings generated by this, because we only have essentially 2 months worth of data. But perhaps down the road, maybe we'll be able to look at it when we have maybe a year's worth of data.
Thank you. I've seen several people in court when they were told they could pay by, they were asking for time to pay and were being threatened by the judge to be put on probation until they were told they could pay by credit card. Then they were very happy to get paid that day. Senator Newton, did you have a question, sir? You're good. Anyone else? Yes, Representative McNeil.
I just have a quick one. I'm trying to get my head around this third-party vendor. Is that like PayPal? Is that how that works?
Essentially.
Thank you. And one last question from the chair. Those costs, those implementation costs, are those one time or are those annual costs for implementation?
I believe there would be one time cost.
And I guess
but
there
I'm
would
not
be
sure if some of the software we're using, there may be some ongoing cost for software.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Nothing further? Thank you so much. We do appreciate
you
being
Mr.
up
Chair.
Here for both those issues.
All
thank
right,
you,
thank
Ms.
You.
Spearman. Last, we have salsa. Those of you who want to know what salsas are, that is not a Mexican condiment. That is actually Special Assistant United States Attorney, collaborations between the states and the U.S. Attorney's Office. And we have Jim O'Neill, Forsyth County District Attorney, who is coming up to address us on this issue. Jim, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Senator Goolsbee, and thank you for allowing me to come and speak today on the SALSA program. What the SALSA program is, it is your Special Assistant United States Attorney. It's a state prosecutor who is cross-sworn to prosecute both in state and in federal court. This program began in 2006. It was made possible through the Governor's Crime Commission funding. There are a number of districts and counties that have the GCC-funded SAUSAs right now, Forsyth County being one of them. What the SAUSAs do primarily is they focus on crimes committed with guns, drugs, bank robberies, and other violent offenders. The whole concept is that we try to focus resources on the worst of the worst. The worst criminals that we see, they are the ones that we're trying to take off the streets for as long as we possibly can. The advantages of having a SAUSA in your office are essentially that federal prosecutors obviously have more legal tools at their disposal. Such as investigative grand juries. The federal government has stronger and longer sentences for the same crimes. Okay, in this slide, as you can see, a firearm case, what we typically call in state court a felon in possession of a firearm, as you can see, if that case is taken to federal court, that person is going to receive a 6-year sentence. And these are rough numbers I'm giving you. Of course, it all depends on their record level as well. And you look at what that same, for the same crime, the same defendant, if that person is left in state court, they can be looking at a probationary sentence, again, depending on their individual criminal record. Drug cases, we can catch somebody 5 years in federal court. Again, they're looking at probation in state court. And some of these other violent felonies, whether they're bank robberies or armed robberies of businesses, 15 years in federal court and 3.5 years in state court. Generally speaking, the crimes that are prosecuted in federal court are not prosecuted at the state level. The criminals who are incarcerated federally obviously are not in North Carolina's Department of Corrections. Now, I can tell you, and I know this is true in many counties, in Forsyth County, if we take our SAUSA, who works for me out of my state office and spends all his time in federal court, he takes a particular criminal and they indict that criminal in federal court. Although that defendant may still be housed in our local jail, they're actually now being paid for by the federal government. Okay, again, the numbers I'm showing you here are going to be, they're rough estimates, but if you look at the cost of a typical state prosecution for a Class D felony, so what is a Class D felony? That's going to be generally an armed robbery, a kidnapping, a burglary. The kidnapping and the burglary would be eligible for federal prosecution if there was a gun involved. So the typical cost in state court for one of those crimes is $3,400. You look at one SAUSA prosecuting those cases in the Western District 32 times in 2013, it ends up being a total savings to the state of $110,000. Now, that's only for one SAUSA, and if you notice, we had 12 or 13 statewide. So, the next slide will show you, when you break down those 32 cases, 9 of them were firearm cases. In other words, a felon in possession of a gun. Looking at a state sentence of probation, the savings to, and it says DOC, but what we're really talking about now, I guess the correct terminology is adult, could be probation. It could be, it's not just putting them in jail. It's the probation aspect of that as well. The savings on those 9 cases, the DOC was $35,000. The drug cases, 13 of them in state court, they receive a probationary sentence. That's a savings of $51,000. The other type of violent felonies, or 10 others of those, state court, they're looking at 3.5 years. The savings to the state is $965,000 for a total of more than $1 million. Again, that's just for one SOSA in one county. I've been prosecuting and I've been elected district attorney for about 6 years now, but prior to that, I was also an assistant DA for 12 or 13 years. So most of my adult legal livelihood has been in through the prosecutor's office. And I can tell you without a doubt that the experienced criminals know the difference between getting prosecuted in federal court and getting prosecuted in state court. We had one this week where we had an officer-involved shooting, and we found a bunch of dope on our defendant, and he was not interested in playing ball with the state investigators. But once the feds got involved, he knew right away what that meant, that he was looking at a whole lot more time. So the experienced criminals, once again, know the difference right away between what they're looking at in state court and what they're looking at in federal court. There's certainly more increased cooperation and more increased information coming with the threat of federal prosecution. Again, you know, we're not picking on one drug dealer. We're looking at the worst of the worst, those individuals that remain a continuous violent plague in our communities. And the SOSAs do an outstanding job of keeping our communities safer for a longer period of time. So almost at the end here, one SOSA position funded by the state would run us about $82,000. Annual savings state court, you know, you're looking at more than $1 million. So it's a small investment, and you look at the savings that the state can realize over a period of time. And this is just financially, not to mention, of course, how much safer your own communities are going to be when you take these people out of play and put them where they need to be. And again, it's only targeting the worst of the worst. I would tell you also that the word is that we have about 1 year left on this SOSA program. And so my suggestion, humbly and respectfully, Mr. Chair, is that we consider pilot programs in a number of counties. And my suggestion to the committee would be, when you're trying to decide where to put these pilots, would be to focus on areas that also have a federal courthouse right nearby. Our federal courthouse is right across the street from the state courthouse. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't know if there's any questions.
Thank you so much. Mr. Prosecutor, do we have any questions for any of the members? Yes, Representative Stevens.
And I think it's not as much a question as a comment until while we're hearing about SOSAs today. As Mr. O'Neill said, the Governor's Crime Commission is intended to be more of an incubator to try innovative new things, and then the groups are expected to go out and get their own funding from somewhere. The problem is SOSAs have no ability to raise funds, and we're hoping that the state will consider adding these into the budgets.
Yes, ma'am.
Can somebody explain to me exactly what the cost is? I mean, because you're using resources the state's already paying for, which is your current. I mean, because we have them in our county. We Ben David has, I think Ben has two, I believe. What is the Crime Commission funding? Are they literally paying for the people in your office, and that isn't on your budget now?
Well, essentially, what they're doing is they're paying for the salaries, benefits. And a computer, I believe, is the total.
Okay. And so in your office, Jim, you went out and hired an additional person under that grant?
Well, what we did was when we were given the $82,000 initially, you know, it's difficult to go find a lawyer off the street that's going to close down their practice and come in and take a job for $82,000, someone who at least who's going to be experienced enough to get up and running in federal court. So what we did was we took our that money, that $82,000, we hired somebody in at the district court level. In other words, somebody right out of law school. And I took my one of my more experienced prosecutors and slid him across the street. So he was able to hit the ground running. There wasn't much of a learning curve. And, you know, a typical prosecutor right now, when we get a new person in our office, makes somewhere around $30,000, $35,000. But the cost of funding that prosecutor is somewhere about $75,000 or $80,000. So we're right in the ballpark.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative McNeil.
Thank you. It sounds like a wonderful program. Do you have some kind of data you could provide us on exactly how many cases y'all have handled through this program?
Yeah, we can provide you, Representative McNeil, with not only how many cases are reviewed, because that's a process, too, to actually review the case and determine whether or not a defendant can be taken across the federal court for prosecution, because there was a federal case that came out. I know Senator Goolsbee is well aware of this, the Simmons case, which explained what a felon is according to definition in federal court. So they have to, again, it's not the first person that walks out of the street and commits a crime. This person has to have accumulated a record over a period of time, felony record, so that we can target the worst of the worst. But we can provide you with numbers of cases reviewed and cases prosecuted, cases tried, cases taken pleas on. We can get you those numbers. Yes, sir.
Senator Bryant.
I might have missed something. I was doing a little multitasking over here. Could you explain why, what your reasoning is for needing co-location with the federal courthouse itself?
Yes, ma'am. I was just throwing that out as a suggestion. If this committee were to decide that perhaps a pilot program would be a great way to get started, just for proximity purposes, I know that most of the DAs around the state that have had the benefit of the sauces did the same thing I did, which was take an experienced prosecutor and slide them across the street. And it's really the proximity to federal court and state court which has made it extremely easy for the two offices to get together. And as I was explaining to Representative McNeil, a person comes out of and commits their first crime, it's very unlikely they qualify for federal prosecution, and depending on their age as well. So they had to accumulate a record over a period of time, and then you have to determine whether or not the case is viable in federal court in terms of evidentiary issues. And so we get together in Forsyth County twice a month to discuss which cases should be adopted in federal court.
Follow up.
So does that mean it can't be done? I'm just interested. I know I'm in like Nash. Our district is Nash, Edgecombe, Wilson. Yeah. Okay. And is it not feasible if you aren't in that proximity?
No. I don't mean to suggest that at all. It's absolutely feasible. I was just trying to make a suggestion to try and secure the funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just leaving out our small town.
Thank you. I have Representative McNeil next. Who else was trying to speak? Okay. After Representative McNeil, or unless you have an answer for her.
I was just going to tell Representative Senator Bryant that there is one in Edgecombe, Nash, and Wilson, and it may be that we could get one on up in the more rural areas where they're having a lot of criminal problem. I'm just on the Governor's Crime Commission, which is how I found out about all of this, and we've studied a lot of this information.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Representative McNeil.
My question was, and you said you took an experienced prosecutor and slid him across the street. Are you meaning that the federal government pays for the office space, the phones, and all associated equipment and everything cost? Or,
well, in our situation, we have an office over there that had readily available offices available and phone lines available and those sorts of things. So I can only speak in terms of my own particular situation. We provided him with books, computer, and a legal assistant as well. So that came out of our pocket. But it just depends on each individual situation what the federal government has available. But you know, I can also tell you, Representative McNeil, that in speaking with the U.S. attorneys around the state, that they love this program. They would love to see it going, continue operating. And I feel confident they would try and do everything they could to accommodate the state.
Any other questions from members? Senator Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for being here today. I didn't know a lot about this program before your presentation. And I can certainly see why the state would be interested in looking at this. But I wasn't sure I gathered from your presentation, what do the feds get out of it? We're talking about shifting, apparently shifting a lot on the federal system. Is it the forfeitures? What is it that they get out of this?
What they get out of it is they're sort of like the district attorney's offices around the state. You know, everybody could use more personnel. And so when they're focusing more on Hobbs Act violations and greater conspiracies and drug trafficking cases, they don't necessarily have the ability and the resources to say, well, you know, we had a jewelry store that two people were shot in and an armed robbery, a serious armed robbery. And in state court, those people were looking at, you know, 10 to 15 years, and over across the street, they're 25 to life. And that's really more, and a more appropriate sentence for someone that would commit that violent a crime against one of our hardworking business owners. And so they see that when you take out the bad people as well, the whole crime rate seems to go down, and they don't have as many, their caseload will go down as well eventually, because of you're taking out the drug co-conspirators and the people committing these violent crimes.
Yes, sir. Any other questions? Mr. McNeil, thank you so much for driving over and being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Well, we're doing a record job here. It's only 2 hours and 20 minutes into our meeting, and we are at the end of our presentations. We do have another 2.5 hours or so available for a committee discussion, if you so desire. Senator Bryant, you may start.
Yes, I'd like to have the first hour. No, have 2 hours. One is back in December, there were some questions about the funding of ABC law enforcement by ABC boards and local police, and how that dovetailed with the ALE, and like who is really doing what, and how much money do we really have for alcohol law enforcement. And I wondered, and I know there were some things staff was doing. Will we still follow up on that? And also Commissioner Gardner is here, and so I want to look out for all my constituents.
Absolutely.
They may want to make some remarks.
Sure. And I believe that staff has tried to start gathering up those numbers, and we have not gotten a great response from our sheriffs across the state. Is that right? I'll recognize Christine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Sheriff's Association was kind enough to survey the sheriffs. And I believe last week, and they had gotten 40 responses. So there's 60 still outstanding. And the chiefs of police sent out a survey for me as well, and I got 20 responses back from them. So we're not getting the best response from the local law enforcement entities. We're going to try to contact some of them directly and see. But based on what we have gotten back so far, it looks like most law enforcement agencies are relying on ALE to do the alcohol law enforcement. They do not have dedicated officers. There's exceptions to that. Jacksonville is a big exception to that because they have so many bars in Jacksonville for the Marines, I guess.
After three combat tours.
So they feel like they need more enforcement. So they do have dedicated officers assigned for that, but it is not paid for by ABC, by the ABC boards.
Representative Speciale, would you like to comment on that?
I just don't think it's just the Marines.
Thank you. It's always nice to have a little humor at the end of the day. Any other committee discussion?
I have one other item, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Commissioner Gardner would like, I'd just like for him to be recognized if he'd like to say anything. That was one item.
I am always glad to hear from my good friend Jim Gardner if he is in the room and would like to say anything. Yes, sir. Governor, always a pleasure. Please.
First of all, I feel like I spent a day in court today.
You did.
Now I know why I didn't go to law school. I would like to comment on it. I've been spending a lot of time concerning enforcement of the ABC laws in the state. When I was here back in December and we talked about it, I think I expressed to you at that time that I was very much concerned about the quality of enforcement that we've had. In looking at it, I think maybe the blame starts with ABC Commission. In the past, we just simply have not been clear in what our goals were as far as enforcement of the ABC laws in the state. We have a number of different agencies, starting with ALE, with our local ABCs, with the sheriff's departments, and local PDs. The bottom line is we spend about $15 million a year in enforcement of the ABC laws in the state. If you would ask me to grade that, I would give it a D minus. An example will be the sheriff's departments, and I have great respect for the sheriff's departments all over the state. This is not a priority with them. And yet this past year, in 2013, we spent $2 million in contracts with sheriff's departments throughout the state to administer the ABC laws. We're concerned about not a child who's under 21 getting a ticket. We're concerned about where did he get the alcohol from, the source. We work very closely with ALE. We're working with the local ABC operations, 14 of them in the state who have their own enforcement, to not concentrate on passing out tickets to teenagers, but to concentrate on who had an ABC permit and sold that child under 21 some form of alcohol. In 2013, spending $2 million with the sheriff's departments, we had reported to the ABC commission for us to act upon 4 violations. $2 million in contracts with the sheriff's departments, we had 4 violations. We spent an additional $1 million contracting with local police departments. We had 41 cases reported to the ABC Commission. The reason I mentioned that to you today is because of this. If you, I think, understand my concern about underage drinking and the problems that we have in our state, there's one agency in the state that carries a big stick. That's ABC Commission. You cannot obtain alcohol in the state of North Carolina without getting it from a permitted establishment, either our ABC stores, restaurants, bars, private clubs, etc. We issue those permits at the ABC Commission. There's 60,000 of them right now outstanding in the state of North Carolina. We also have the responsibility, if the people who have the permits do not abide by the law, that permit can be revoked. And what we are concentrating on this year, and I'm working very closely with ALE and with our local ABC boards, to revise everything that we've been doing in the past and start concentrating on the source of where the alcohol products are coming from. We think by doing that, we can make a substantial reduction in underage drinking in the state. But I did want to point out, and it's certainly no reflection on the sheriff's departments. I've talked with sheriffs. They have a full plate. They have a lot going on. Alcohol is not a priority with them. We want to change that. We're going to be meeting with our ALE representatives, with our local ABC boards, with the sheriff's departments and local PDs who have contracts right now, to see if we can't start approaching it, going after the source of where the alcohol comes from. So are we satisfied right now? Absolutely not. We're not doing a good job. Are we planning to change it? Absolutely. And I think if I came here probably in 6 months, we'll have much better news to talk to you about. We're concerned about the problem. We are aware about the problem, and we're going to make some changes.
Thank you, Governor. Do any of the committee members have any questions while we have Governor Gardner here? Thank you so much,
Thank
sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Any more committee discussion? If not, I will...
I have one more item.
Okay, one more item.
And
yes, ma'am.
And this is quick. I was just interested in, could we get an update on, I've gotten some constituent concerns about juvenile justice, mm-hmm. some sort of continuing dismantling of their functions and spreading them out. I just wanted some reassurance that somebody's got their eye on the ball in terms of juvenile justice and prevention, and we know what the impact of all these changes are. Is that, can we get an update on that before we wind up?
Yes, Ms. Fox, can you help us on that?
Sure. What kind of update would you like to?
I could talk to you. I don't want to hold up people. I could talk to you about it in more detail, and I have already been sending some communications to a staff, but I can surely come up and talk to you about it. I don't want to hold up the group members if they're ready to leave.
Yes, Senator. We're working on getting new organizational charts for you that are down to the much more detailed level that you requested, so mm-hmm. that's on its way, and then I'd be happy to talk to you about your other concerns.
Thank you.
And if you would, Ms. Fox, if you could forward those on to the committee members as you present them to Senator Bryan.
Yes, I will.
We'd appreciate that. Chair is now ready to entertain a motion for adjournment. It is moved by Senator Newton, seconded by Senator Bryan. All in favor, aye. No? We're done.